Hello, I'm Jane Crowe, the editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. Today, I'm joined by our deputy editor, Matt Matum.
Hello.
And our contributing editor, James Mottram.
Hello.
Hello. And this week, we're going to be talking Black Widow, Freaky, Another Round, French Exit, and Lady Boss, the Jackie Collins story. And one of those, well, quite a few of them spoke to me, but one of those particularly did in a leopard print fashion. But before we start on those, what have you guys been watching this week? Have you been watching anything outside of our selection this week?
I managed to catch up with Together, which was the sort of BBC one-off drama directed by Stephen Daldry, starring James McAvoy and Sharon Horgan as this couple. It takes you all the way through lockdown, and it's this kind of fracturing couple. And there's a lot of fourth wall breaking in it. It's almost a two-hander, but not quite. And a really impressive piece of work, I have to say. It kind of brought a lot of back what we've all been going through in the last year, but in a really quite poignant way.
Yeah, I've seen him sort of talking about that on his social media and people really loving it. And it's on my list, but I haven't got round to it. Have you, Matt?
No, I love those two. So it's on my list for that reason, because I'd kind of watch anything that either of them were in. So something they're in together is like a must watch for me. The main thing I've been watching this week, of course, is the football yesterday. Like who could not watch it? Come on.
I didn't.
Oh, Jane. It's coming home, Jane. Come on.
No, zero interest in football.
I know James likes football, but I'm very much not a football fan at any time outside of international tournaments. But I love it when the international tournaments are going, just because it's just always on. There's always a match you can watch. And then obviously it's kind of just the whole knockout element is always exciting, you know. And plus, we're doing pretty well, so.
Ooh. Yeah, but unless it's got Sylvester Stallone in it, I'm not interested. Oh, God, honestly, I can't wait to be over.
So would you not watch the final if they go all the way?
Absolutely not. I'll go and watch a really good film instead. I have absolutely no interest, categorically not.
But there'll be too much noise in the country. You won't be able to hear wherever cinema you're in. There'll be screaming everywhere.
Well, that's the thing. I was actually watching a film when it was on, and I could tell how we were doing by what the neighbours were shouting. I feel like I get that inkling as I go. But shall we crack on then? Because we've got lots to talk about this week, haven't we? Shall we start with the big one? It's been a while since we've had an Avengers film. So shall we get our ledgers out and sort out the black and the red with this?
Before I was an Avenger, I made mistakes. And a lot of enemies.
His call sign's Taskmaster. He controls the Red Room. They're manipulated.
Fully conscious, but no choices.
I should have come back for you.
How many others are there?
Enough.
So this is Black Widow. We've waited a while. We did two covers on it. This is another one of those ones that we thought it was coming out twice and it didn't. Matt, tell us about Black Widow.
Yes, it's definitely coming out now, more than a year delayed from its original release date. And it's one of those ones that's hitting cinemas and Disney Plus with Premier Access when you pay a bit more to get it on your Disney Plus. But of course, it is finally the standalone film for Scarlett Johansson's Natasha Romanoff, a.k.a. Black Widow. And obviously she's been around in the MCU for more than 10 years. We've actually, as well as you're saying, we've had a big break between Marvel films, obviously largely because of the pandemic. It's been like just over 2 years since we've actually had one, the last one being Spider-Man Far From Home. And maybe it was a good idea to have a bit of a break after Endgame and everything getting so sort of massive. But this weirdly kind of throws us back a bit, because obviously, spoilers anyone, Black Widow sacrificed herself in Endgame to get the Soul Stone.
So she's gone. Died
then. Yeah, sacrificed herself for the team. So this takes us back to the time kind of between Captain America's Civil War, where all the Avengers were kind of fighting each other over the Sokovia Accords. And between that and when we see her again in Infinity War, that's when this takes place. So it's sort of, judging by the kind of captions on screen, I think it's 2016, because basically we kick off with a little prelude in 1995 Ohio, where we kind of see a little family, all just kind of normal, lovely sort of family life. And then the dad returns home with a kind of, you know, we've all got to get out of the house in an hour. And then it gets, you know, kind of very exciting and very marvelly. But yeah, the majority of the film is set in 2016 and basically fills us in on what Natasha was doing in that in-between time. And it brings back kind of, you know, key figures from her past, and it kind of sets her on this mission to try and destroy the Red Room once and for all, which is this place where obviously all the widows are kind of trained in this really brutal fashion and sent off on these kind of horrible missions against their will. So it's basically, yeah, just kind of digging into her past and also just, you know, giving you this one-off sort of standalone action movie story at the same time.
Obviously, we don't see any of the Avengers. They are discussed in this film, but we are introduced to this family that you mentioned that was the sort of sleeper cell family for Natasha as a child. Tell us about them, James. Obviously, this is Florence Pugh making her debut in the Marvel Universe.
And what a debut she makes, I have to say. She plays Yelena, as you said, a sort of surrogate sister, you could say, to Natasha. She's just as highly trained. When they first encounter each other in a sort of Budapest or Budapest, as they...
running joke about how you pronounce it.
Yes.
I'm
going for Budapest.
Okay.
It's a different one. So when they first encounter each other at this sort of safe house, they have this incredible fight in the kitchen. I mean, it's not just sort of arguing over the cornflakes. It's knives and... Are there frying pans? I can't remember, but it feels like there should be.
Curtains and tea towels.
Yeah. Neck curtains. Never. You'll never look at neck curtains the same again.
You will not. She's obviously an incredibly, as limber, let's say, as Natasha is in these kind of highly trained ways. So we have her, then we have the sort of father figure, Alexei Shostakov, I think, the Red Guardian. He's a sort of co-equal, as he calls himself, of Captain America, obviously from the Russian side of things. Now, finding it a little difficult to squeeze into his old sort of red leather suit, which I think is one of the funniest sequences in the film. And then you have the sort of mother figure, played by Rachel Weisz, Milena. And she's a sort of spy, has been through the Red Room herself, and also a sort of scientist figure. We should probably leave it there as to her involvement.
And also the fixer that pops up with various, goods for Black Widow when she needs to hide out or needs a vehicle. We've got these new characters. We've got a lot of humour that I was not expecting from this. I thought that this was going to be quite bleak from the opener because it is quite hardcore what happens to these girls in the Red Room and the ripping of them from their families and the abuse of them. You know, we're not toying with how bleak this is. You know, there's one scene where Florence Pugh's character discusses how they're all forced to have hysterectomies and, you know, fallopian tubes are ripped out and uteruses are destroyed. I mean, you know, they're not playing on that. But on the other hand, it is very playful in its sort of banter, didn't you think?
Yeah, I completely thought that. I mean, again, talking of Florence Pugh's sort of contribution, she really brings the humour, sort of slightly sardonic look from an outside point of view at the Avengers. She's obviously slightly embittered from having been separated from her sort of sister figure in Natasha, and kind of refers to Natasha as the sort of not one of the most important Avengers, which really I think slightly riles Natasha. And yeah, I really like that humor. It just, again, it just gives you an outsider's perspective on the whole Avengers world, and it really did alleviate some of the bleakness.
She was sort of real in as much as she was very, very pleased with a piece of clothing that she had because it had pockets, and she was hungry on her mission, which constantly when I watch Avengers movies, I think, doesn't anyone want to pee or eat something at any point in all of this? But she's like, oh, a cereal bar. And there was a whole joke about a cereal bar in this film. It really felt like they tried to make this extremely relatable. And in a way, it spoke to me a great deal more on a sort of female experience level than Captain Marvel did, even though that was the sort of benchmark for a female-led Avenger film. This one, I think, actually did more than Captain Marvel. What did you think, Matt?
Yeah, I wonder if you say that because obviously it is definitely one of the more, I mean, I say this very much in air quotes, but grounded entries. I mean, it's kind of clearly takes a leaf out of the Bourne movies books and, like, you know, it's so kind of Bourne, so it so feels like the kind of Marvel spin of a Bourne film anyway, just from the locations, the fighting style, the fact you've got this hero who kind of regrets their past actions and just the style of the fight scenes and everything like that. But then as Marvel, it's just such a kind of well-oiled machine now. Everything they put out is just entertaining, basically. And, you know, you get all these great one-liners. I really like the film overall. I gave it 4 stars. You can read my review online now. But if I had any qualms, it was that I sometimes felt that maybe there was a bit too much joking around some of the serious subjects. Like David Harbour, for example, he's very funny, but there's a couple of times I found some of his jokes a bit too kind of insensitive, you know. There's also this weird, there's this thing that I found a bit weird about it, where because it is that bit more grounded and because you've got Natasha, who's like, you know, one of the few Avengers who doesn't actually have proper superpowers, you know, she's just really kind of highly skilled. There were a few moments where it kind of took me out of it a bit when she survives some quite insane things. Like early on, she falls off a massive building and bashes herself and everything on the way down and just gets up pretty much unscathed, you know. And they obviously reckon with their pasts a lot, like Natasha and Yelena both feel kind of terrible for the things they've had to do in the name of the Red Room in the past against their will, but then they don't mind kind of like blowing away just like, you know, swathes of goons as they need to, and like, you know, they don't seem to care too much for like collateral damage in their big chase scenes and things like that. Because it was more grounded and sort of serious than some of the others, it almost drew attention to things like that for me a bit more than perhaps than if it was just a much more obviously over the top and, you know, comic booky sort of thing. But that said, you know, very, very enjoyable.
I mean, talking of grounded, somebody didn't bother to ground their accent in reality, did they, James? How did you like Ray Winston's Cockney Russian accent?
Uncle Ray, as we like to call him. Yeah, again, if we're nitpicking, he wasn't my favourite element of the film. He was Ray, basically. Mm. It's funny, Matt should mention the Bourne films, because I was more getting a whiff of James Bond. Mm. At one point, yeah, you see Natasha on her laptop watching Moonraker, and there's a certain sort of ludicrousness to the action that reminded me of a sort of Bond film.
And there's also a certain sequence as well in Moonraker where someone jumps out of a plane without a parachute and somebody else jumps out after them and dives to catch them up, which is replicated in the film, which I felt was certainly a nod to that, surely.
Very good spot. And also, it's a little bit of Mission Impossible going on in there.
There's
slight face swapping moment as well, which we won't go into. But it is slightly toying with these sort of movie spies that we sort of know and love. And we should say that it's Kate Shortland directing, the Australian director, who, you know, really is not known for these kinds of types of films. You know, she did Somersault years ago and Berlin Syndrome. Fascinating films, but, you know, sort of character-driven movies. But I think she's, you know, stepped up incredibly here to wed this action with the humour, with the sort of the Marvel storyline as well. I think she did a fantastic job.
Yeah, that's one of the things that really worked overall for me, was the fact that the emotional bits do really land. And I think if they didn't, you know, it would have not worked anywhere near as well, and perhaps wouldn't have forgiven some of those sillier moments. But because, particularly in the kind of relationship between Natasha and Yelena, because you just really do care about that, you know, and they do get this kind of warmth between the family, it's really kind of impressively manages to make you care, even though, you know, it's one of those films you kind of go into it a bit thinking like, well, I know what happens to Natasha in the end. Do we really need this? But it
adds real nuance to that, doesn't it? Because now knowing what you know comes after it, it's even sadder, and that's sort of emotionally satisfying. So I think we're probably saying that you should go and see this. And I would say, although it is available on Disney Plus, which for your convenience is great, if you want to see it on the big screen, it's probably the best place to see it, because this is a spectacle, right?
Yeah, yes. I mean, the action is superb right from the beginning. A sort of prologue with a biplane sequence, let's call it, a sort of desperate takeoff moment. There's an incredible chase through the streets of Budapest. You know, it's so much great action in it. I really enjoyed the action in this, and again, from seeing it on a big screen, which we've obviously missed, and it just looked fantastic.
Mm-hmm. So if you want to see it on a big screen, it's in cinemas on Wednesday, the 7th of July, and it's on Disney Plus from the 9th of July. You just need to add a small fee to your subscription. Okay, so shall we have some more women kicking ass with this?
He's like a wolf in sheep's clothing. Who knows how many of our friends he's going to kill?
Are you sure this is safe?
No.
Oh my God, it's a slaughterhouse.
I have like less than 6 hours to swap back, or I'm gonna be stuck in this body forever.
Hurry up, loser, I gotta take a dump.
I have to admit, it hasn't been all bad.
I'm sorry, sir, I didn't mean to interrupt. I...
Move! How's that feel?
I'll make you wish your stupid face was never born.
Oh my God, did you just pee yourself?
Yes!
So this is Freaky. James, tell us about this one.
It is a riff, let's say, on the classic body swap comedy Freaky Friday with Jamie Lee Curtis and Lindsay Lohan. This has got a little bit of a horror bent to it, though. It's your sort of classic high school setting. We have a high school student, Millie, played by Catherine Newton. She's, you know, obviously not one of the popular kids, not one of the cool kids. And at a certain point, she's chased by this local sort of serial killer called the Blissfield Butcher, played by Vince Vaughn.
I love the way you say that, like the local serial killer, like every single village has a serial killer. Oh, that's our local serial killer.
Well, I should say in this film, they all seem to know who he is and even recognise him. So it seems to be a local hero of sorts. And no, the police have not bothered to catch him. But that's an aside. He's stolen this kind of magic dagger. And when he catches her sort of on the football field, he stabs her with this dagger. And then there's a sort of big flash and boosh, their bodies are swapped, basically. And suddenly she is the butcher and he is the high school student. So she has got up till midnight to try and somehow swap the bodies back, or they'll be permanently encased in each other's bodies. Of course, the comedy here is Vince Vaughn suddenly playing a high school girl, finding his inner high school girl. And that's where the film, you know, leaves off from.
Yeah, it is funny. It's also incredibly brutal. I mean, there's some deaths in this that I winced at, but there is the fun in watching Vince Vaughn do that thing, which is akin to watching Jack Black do the same thing in Jumanji. And when somebody as sort of talented and sort of laconic as him doing it, I found it really worked. I really enjoyed this. Did you guys?
I enjoyed it, but in a sort of throwaway fun kind of way. Like, as James would say, it's a really great concept. And it's the sort of film that, again, I saw this at home, but I would like to see this in the cinema because it is the kind of film you want to be sort of laughing along with, because it just doesn't take itself seriously. I mean, as James was kind
of saying, there's no real logic involved, is there?
There's no real logic, no real threat, really, because, you know, it's just, as James would say, it's this weird thing where he's sort of like the local serial killer that everyone, yeah, kind of knows, but he hasn't been stopped yet, and just so tongue-in-cheek. And it kind of, you know, has these title cards that play on, like, leading up to Friday the 13th. And, like, I wondered even if they were originally going to call it Freaky Friday the 13th, but maybe there was, like, copyright issues or something. And as you say, there's some kind of ridiculously over-the-top gore that you could imagine kind of, again, like, laughing along to in the cinema. But I must admit, it didn't really sort of stay with me or anything like that. Like, it was just kind of a bit of fun in the moment, but yeah, not one I would kind of return to.
It doesn't feel like they're trying to make anything deep. It feels very much like this is your Friday night fun popcorn audience pleaser, right?
Yeah, I mean, that is exactly when I watched it on a Friday night, and it did hit that post-pub kind of movie where, you know, you probably had a bit too much to drink, and it kind of works well. I thought it went on too long. I thought it could have stopped and it would have been a bit punchier. And it's not exactly a long film as it is, but to some degree, it's a kind of, you know, one idea, one note kind of movie. But it's, as Matt was saying, it's a great idea. Vaughn is absolutely hilarious as the sort of inner high school girl. He does play that very, very well, it must be said.
Yeah. And I also sort of thought, there's the moment, no spoilers, but it's quite progressive in, you know, one of the boys who is a sort of a jock behaves in a way that you wouldn't expect. And there's a romantic connotation that is quite unexpected, which I thought top marks for in showing that guys don't have to be one thing. I liked that.
There you go. Yes. No, I'm not sure if that was at the top of its agenda, but you're right.
No. Oh, no. I'm not saying it was. I felt like that it was incredibly modern in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I almost felt, though, like not in that specifically, but just in general, I felt it could have pushed it a bit further in, you know, what it was saying about a kind of, you know, high school life and that kind of thing.
It's totally self-aware, though, isn't it? You know, like, at one point someone runs through the corridor saying, "You're black, I'm gay, we're so going to die." You know, it totally understands its genre.
That was a good line, actually. I really enjoyed Vince Vaughn's bed. I was slightly obsessed by the Blissfield Butcher's serial killer bed. All he slept on was a horrible old mattress.
With loads of hung pets around.
Yeah, no bed frame or anything. I mean, you know, how's he going to get his sleep, you know, if he's killing people?
So are we recommending that this is a good post-pub Friday night outing?
Yeah. So I'd say it needs to be caveated with that. You know, if you've had a drink, yeah, go along.
Yeah, drink responsibly and then go and watch it.
Yeah, true. And, you know, do everything else responsibly because, you know, there's a lot of irresponsible behaviour in this film. Okay, so that is Freaky and it is in cinemas on Friday. And don't go expecting it to be just a nice family adventure like the previous films. It is quite dark. Okay, it's time for alternative line reading and popping his cherry. Matt Matum.
Oh, yeah. Here I go then. I'm going to attempt to do this in the style of Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Okay.
Here we go. I'm afraid, Dave. Dave, my mind is going. I can feel it. I can feel it. My mind is going.
2001?
Oh, you got it straight away.
Well, you put the name of the person in it, you fool.
There must be a lot of films of people called Dave in it.
Yeah,
there?
I didn't get that.
It's a classic. It's an absolute classic. And of course, as we always have learnt with this, play the player, not the game. And I know what Matt's bent is for films, and it's Kubrick. So that was relatively easy.
I'm afraid, Dave. Dave, my mind is going.
I did enjoy your Austrian sort of enunciation there.
Could we announce the 2001 remake with Arnold Schwarzenegger as Hal?
It's only a matter of time, surely, isn't it? Yeah.
Someone's probably going to think of that, I'm sure. Okay, shall we move on? Shall we charge our glasses now and get ready for this?
Afhældning. Daglig indtagelse af alkohol. Ja. Tilstræbt konstant niveau på en halv promille.
Med henblik på indsamling af evidens.
Ja.
Psykologiske
og psykoretoriske følgevirkninger samt undersøgelse af forøget social og faglig udvikling.
Det er kun i arbejdstiden, vi drikker, ikke?
Men det er jo ligesom Hemingway. Vi drikker ikke efter 8 og ikke i weekend.
So this is another round, the award-winning Danish film. Who's drinking in this, James?
Well, the lead is the great Mads Mikkelsen, back on his home turf and working again with co-writer, director Thomas Vinterberg. They previously made The Hunt, which won Mikkelsen Best Actor in Cannes a few years ago. And this is actually a story that they've been developing pretty much since that time. Mikkelsen plays Martin, a middle-aged history teacher. He's married, he's a father, and he's kind of suffering from a sort of classic midlife crisis. He hasn't bought a Porsche, I don't think, in the film, but he's going in that direction, I think. He's just sort of depressed. And so are his three of his sort of male colleagues who work at the school. They're equally sort of maudlin and morose. And they hit upon this idea, which is actually inspired by a real life Norwegian psychiatrist, which is basically using alcohol to sort of top up the alcohol level in your bloodstream, just a small amount, effectively to keep yourself happy, I suppose you could say. And they decide to do it at work, of course, a school, and to experiment. They have certain rules. They're not going to do it in the evening. It's really to see how this alcohol will affect their moods and will it make them more creative? And the film goes on from there. He finds a new purpose in life after experimenting with this alcohol.
I mean, this is a much lighter subject than The Hunt, and it sounds quite jolly when you're describing it like that, but it does sort of delve into the psychology of people experiencing sort of NU and depression, and also the pitfalls of alcohol. But it is also quite amusing in the bits when they are getting drunk, isn't it? I mean, did you like those tonal shifts that they tried to do in this?
I'm going to express shock at Jane here, where I was recently looking at a page in Total Film magazine, and she gave this film 3 stars, which I was really surprised by, because I know it won recently the Oscar and all that kind of stuff, so it's obviously hugely lauded. But I did really, really like this film, because I just felt like, especially in Mads Mikkelsen's performance, he just so captured that sort of middle-aged ennui. And I just love that kind of look at the sort of drinking culture. And it was one of those films as well that perhaps I wasn't absolutely blown away with on first viewing, but it really, really kind of stayed with me afterwards. And without going into spoilers, but you will have no doubt heard by now that there's just this amazing sort of dance sequence in it.
Yes.
And that just really stuck with me afterwards as well. I think is one of the sort of scenes of the year really for me. And yeah, just so it just really, really sort of stuck with me and really found it quite poignant. But interested to know why you weren't quite so blown away, Jane, as some people.
Because I found that it was quite predictable. I could guess exactly what would happen and, you know, which of the characters may come out of it not so well as others. And I found that ending, although sort of uplifting, sort of narratively unsatisfying. I didn't know where it was leaving me, and so I didn't think it was as good as everybody else. So I gave it 3 stars, so I'm saying it's a good piece of work. Mm-hmm. and I really enjoyed the performances, but I didn't think cohesively it worked entirely for me.
I'm with Matt, I'm afraid. I saw this last year and it remained in my 10 of the year. And again, it's when you watch a film, it's about context. And, you know, we were in that lockdown period of not seeing so many great films. So many films got shifted and moved around. And I was interested in seeing it anyway. It was actually selected for Cannes last year. And then, of course, the festival was cancelled, but it retained the Cannes label. You knew it had to have something about it, but and I'd been anticipating it. But as Matt said, that final sequence, the dance sequence, I found that extremely uplifting. In a way, I hadn't with much else that had been around at the time. I thought Mikkelsen's performance was great. I mean, he's always great, but I thought he was fantastic in this. I suppose I could see what you're saying about its predictability, but I think I felt I needed a little bit of sentiment at that point, and maybe I was in need of being uplifted myself at that point.
No, I just thought that it didn't go dark enough. It sort of toyed with the idea of alcohol and the idea of society's reliance on it, because, you know, this is all tied up as well with the celebrations that students have at his school, and that this is all intrinsically tied with boozing and boozing to great extent. And I thought there's something really interesting to be said there that wasn't said. And it sort of veered off and didn't quite dare to go there. So that was also what I felt disappointed by.
I think originally they talked about, rather than setting it in a school and him playing a teacher, they were going to set it in a air traffic control tower.
You see, that already interests me more.
Well, that would be seriously dark if they're drunk and controlling
airplanes. Imagine the repercussions of that. But that's the thing. That's what I'm saying. It's quite interesting, isn't it, that we as a society tolerate drinking, and drinking to the point that they're all absolutely falling around in a supermarket, which is a funny scene, but that is a societal view on alcohol, that it's an acceptable drug. But then if you put that abuse of alcohol that they're doing, you know, it's in a school and it's like, that's not really appropriate. Yeah. But the only sort of thing is a stuffy school headmistress having a go at them. That's the only sort of thing. If it was in a tower and you could kill 300, 400 people in a plane if you got it wrong, then it wouldn't be okay, would it?
There would be more jeopardy. I can grant you that.
Do you see what I'm saying? I sort of found it dissatisfying.
I kind of get that. And I should say as well, a couple of others from Total Film that I know I've spoken to since, Matthew Leyland and Jamie Graham, who are regulars on the pod, I know they feel similarly to Jane. Yeah, I suppose I found it more sort of ambiguous rather than, like, you know, kind of not necessarily going dark enough. And even the ending, which I found sort of uplifting, but I think again it's very, without going to spoilers, very specifically ends on a sort of ambiguous note, in the way it kind of freeze frames at the end. I felt like it left you with a lot to kind of mull over afterwards without kind of necessarily particularly hammering home aside, but obviously everyone interprets it differently, so.
And that's the joy of it.
I don't think anyone would disagree. Well, yeah, there's been talk that there always is, isn't there, after the film wins the Best International Oscar. Yeah, like Leonardo DiCaprio's production company doing it, but I don't know about that. I don't think we need it.
And also, I think it would lose a certain charm, wouldn't it, if it was just transposed to America and it was, you know, guys drinking in America. I think there's something really charming about this being actually Danish and the school life that you see being portrayed here. Yeah.
Especially the opening sequence, which is sort of footage from this kind of, I suppose, graduation drinking game that the youngsters play, where they're racing around a kind of, I think it's a lake.
A lake. And every time you get round, you have to drink a beer.
But more to the point, they're carrying large boxes of bottles of beer with them while racing around this lake and then chugging the beer and then racing onwards and obviously making themselves rather ill.
I was once in Sweden randomly when they were doing this sort of thing that kind of like what they do at the end, you know, when they take those sort of open bus things around when the kind of students are doing that to graduate. I literally had no idea what was going on, you know, and then that happened and just bizarre.
There we go. Did you find yourself doing a dance on a quayside?
Oh, I wish. If I could go back in time, I would do.
Okay, so that is Another Round, and that is out in cinemas this Friday. Okay, do we fancy a trip to Paris, boys? Voila, here is this.
When I came to Paris the first time,
merci beaucoup.
Something sent up an alert. It was the presentiment of what was to come.
We're going to lie down. Will you come visit us later?
Was she paying you?
Paying me?
Aren't you her gigolo?
Oh, God, no. That's my mother.
Okay, so this is French Exit. Matt, who's making a French exit in this film?
Making a French exit here is Michelle Pfeiffer and Lucas Hedges. They play a sort of mother and son, and she's a sort of formerly wealthy socialite who basically discovers that she's pretty much bankrupt, and her only real, you know, chance of getting any sort of money, as she's advised, is just sell all her valuables quickly for cash and then, you know, take the money and run, basically, before a house is sort of repossessed. So that's where we kind of start the story. Then mother and son basically go on a trip to France, Paris, you know, so it is literally a French exit. There's not really loads that happens in this film along the way. They meet lots of sort of, you know, quirky characters, and with them as well, I mean, an element I kind of liked, they've got their cat with them. And
yeah, in a bag.
They've funny you should say that, because they do sort of drug the cat at one point, put him in a little bag to kind of help get him through customs. And basically we sort of find out that, like, you know, they believe the spirit of her late husband and his father is, you know, living within the cat. And so that's one of the reasons why they're sort of loath to leave it behind. It's one of those films, again, James, I know you've seen this as well, so I'll be keen to know what you think as well, but I've really, really struggled to get on with this film. Like, I know Jane hasn't seen it, and Jane,
and you know why I haven't seen it? Because the trailer irritated me so much with its quirky Wes Anderson light that I just thought, I think I'll save that for a plane.
You just stolen what I was exactly going to say. It is quirky with a capital Q. Wes Anderson would be the obvious comparison, especially as Wes sort of has a love for all things Parisian as well. His new film, The French Dispatch, is coming up. I did not get on with it. I enjoyed the feline humour. I mean, I love anything with cats, so that went down.
But not cats, though, right?
Well, obviously obviously not that cat, no. There were kind of elements that I enjoyed when they're in this Paris apartment. Kind of more and more oddball people start turning up, kind of waifs and strays, and that gets quite amusing, but it's not that funny. Michelle Pfeiffer, you know, she is on good form as this sort of, you know, incredibly withering socialite. I did enjoy her performance in it. I think there was a lot of talk early on that she was going to get an Oscar nomination. It didn't quite happen for her in the end, but it's a pretty solid performance from her. But as I say, quirky with a capital Q.
Did you find that, Matt?
Yeah, very much so. It's just so kind of arch, and then there's this sort of, yeah, like quirky score that's kind of, you know, playing all the way through. And I knew, Jane, like, I knew you hadn't seen it, but it very much would go into your category of make it end films, definitely, because it's so long, and there are admittedly a few funny moments in it. There's a few funny lines and a few just kind of surreal flourishes. But ultimately, it's just really long. Like I say, everyone they meet is just so sort of self-consciously quirky. No one really feels or talks like a real, like, human character. And that's something I kind of struggled to get on with. And then it just wasn't funny enough. If it was really funny, you know, I could, you know, obviously forgive all those things, and, you know, and it could work with that, the style and everything. But because it just wasn't any of those things, it was just, I just found it a bit of a slog, to be honest.
Oh dear. So not a little French fancy then. More of a sacré bleu.
Yeah.
Okay.
Nice.
Okay. So we are not saying go and see this.
I can't in good conscience.
I think we're saying no.
We're saying, mais non. Okay, so that's his French exit. It's out in cinemas on Friday. Do go and see it if you love Michelle Pfeiffer. But I think we're saying there's other things that you could be watching this week that you probably enjoy more. Before we go on to our final film, let's talk about Plain Talking, which is demystifying the stuff we hear on film sets and what it actually means. So this week, we're talking about Last Man. What's the rule of Last Man, Matt?
This is another one I don't really know.
He doesn't know.
Can someone inform
me? Does James know?
Not particularly. I can't say I've ever heard of that one. Clearly, Jane, you know far more about call sheets than we do.
Do you not just pour over the call sheet whenever you see it?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, the concept of, you know, last man, it's when you can eat lunch. It's like, well, I'll just go and eat lunch straight away. I'll just barge my way to the front of the queue, obviously.
Nice. Yeah. Well, let me tell you then. I mean, all of the hours are very strictly controlled on a film set. You can only work a certain number of hours. You know, if people go over the full amount of time, then they go into turnaround, which means extra money and costs. And that's when films spiral out of control. So lunch is very tightly controlled. So when you have lunch and you call lunch, it doesn't start officially the hour's lunch break until the last man has been served. So when the canteen says, like, that's it, that's the last one, that's when the lunch hour begins. Obviously, not just a man. Can be a lady or an alien or whatever it is that's on set that day. But the last man is the rule of the last person served lunch. Mm. There you go.
So you could have a massive long lunch break if, like, you know, there's loads of people to
serve. If you dawdle. But yes, wow. Because obviously you can't really allow, you know, I don't know, your number one star to have the hour's lunch break because they've finished and are ready to go and there's somebody still serving their potatoes and pie or whatever it is at the back of the queue. They just have to gobble it down and get straight back on it. So that is why they implement it. And that's why also service is extremely brisk on a film set. I mean, they sling that food at you, not in an uncaring way, but that food comes out of that truck pretty fast.
I don't think any of us have ever been last man on a film set because we're always straight in there at the craft services as soon as the hatch is open.
Any opportunity, as soon as they say, oh, lunch is called, you're like, oh, is it? I'll just stroll over there because they are extremely good lunches. And if you listen to this podcast, I think we probably talk about on-set food most weeks because they are an excellent lunch. Okay, final film of the week then. Shall we get on to it? It's time for a bonkbuster.
What she wrote and who she was are two different things. Very few people saw past the facade.
She was the younger sister. It doesn't all go along just perfectly all the time.
He was a gambler, an alcoholic.
He did become extremely controlling.
Her traumatic experiences kept coming back into play.
This is Lady Boss, the Jackie Collins story. And in case you hadn't guessed, it's about Jackie Collins, the famous authoress, sister of Joan Collins, who became an absolute phenomenon in the 80s, writing saucy novels that various people, including Barbara Cartland, decried as disgusting because she was an advocate of women being sexually powerful and voracious as any man. And she declared herself to be a feminist and wanted that for the people in her books. This is quite an interesting documentary because she sort of, as one of her own daughters says, self-documented her own life throughout her life. She wrote copious diaries, took photos, did home videos, kept everything. So there's so much material here to discover what she was thinking at any given time throughout her life and also to give you context of what was happening at certain periods of time. And it's also quite a sad story because this is a woman who was always the younger sister who wasn't the beautiful movie star that Joan Collins was, and a woman who was looking for love. And sadly, illness plagued her life throughout her marriages. Did you enjoy this film? I mean, I loved it because I just think she's absolutely fabulous. And I would say that in a way that does have a hat tip to Absolutely Fabulous, the show, because it is sort of that over-the-top character that she portrayed with the leopard print, big shoulder pads, huge hair, sort of vacuous life that she portrayed. But actually, I found this film really interesting in getting behind that sort of facade.
I did enjoy it. I didn't know a great deal about Jackie Collins. Obviously, I was aware of, you know, the fact she's wrote books, like you said, Hollywood Wives and Lucky and these kind of huge novels. I love the fact that you began your intro with bonkbuster, by the way.
Bonkbuster, come on.
Which is a phrase we've needed to get in the pod for a long time.
I mean, we should think about bonk as a word, shouldn't we? Having a bonk, bonking, all of that.
Bonking starts here then, basically, on the pod. obviously, we should say Joan Collins, her older sister, is interviewed in the film. And, you know, the filmmakers do try and get Joan on their relationship and their, you know, rivalry, I suppose you could say. I mean, you know, Jackie had wanted to be an actress sort of in her early years, but it hadn't really worked out. I think that that's a quite a poignant element of the film as well, looking at their sort of sibling rivalry, their relationship. I guess I didn't really know a great deal about what she stood for, her sort of, you know, empowering feminist message. And that really comes across very well in the film. There's some fabulous archive stuff as well. Particularly, there's a sequence where she's on Loose Women, which I was really quite surprised about. I missed that episode, clearly. But yeah, no, I really did enjoy it, I have to say.
I mean, didn't you love the fact that all of her home movies are like full of famous people? And her diaries are incredible. So her diaries from when she was sort of 18 years old, like went out with Marlon Brando. He's quite fat. Saw this guy, went over to the Bing Crosby's, played table tennis over at Gene Kelly's house. And then when she gets into sort of home videos, she's just home videoing and there's Roger Moore and there's Michael Caine just cutting a birthday cake. It's so fabulous in terms of a sort of Hollywood dream, isn't it? And yet it isn't. But also, as you say, I thought that the sort of segments with Joan were fascinating because she's very revealing, but also extremely guarded. And there's clearly a lot more to say there. And she expresses surprise in reading some of her diary entries of her sisters. So I was just like, I want more of this. I could watch a whole like series. Oh, on
what you want is the Joan documentary.
The Joan documentary, please. Yes. Well,
there is a great bit right at the beginning where I think it's Jackie Collins's assistant, who's one of the first people you see in the film, and Joan is telling this story about a fruit fly.
Yes.
Which she sort of imagined was, it's a bit like French Exit, actually, the sort of embodiment of Jackie, this fruit fly that had been sort of buzzing around her. The film cuts back to the assistant and she goes, oh yeah, the fruit fly story, yeah, we've all heard that one. And it, you know, they're all kind of, I wouldn't say bitchy about each other, but you can tell under the surface there's a lot more to be dug out.
There's that fabulous bit where there's, you know, one of her, I think it's Jackie's sister-in-law, says, you know, I've worked in fashion, so I know bitches. When she's talking about the two sisters, she just drops it and it's just a mic drop. You get the sense of this sort of turmoil and bitchiness that was going on, but people are too polite to say. But also it's just fascinating as well that a lot of the people in there doing sort of talking heads about Jackie all think that they were her best friend simultaneously. So it's this fascinating idea of Jackie being everything to all people and being this sort of incredibly charismatic person, but then inside her diary said a completely different thing.
Did you also enjoy basically the kind of voyeuristic look onto this, the lives of these now quite old, most of the interviewees, but they're sort of incredibly wealthy lifestyles that they've clearly lived, incredible sort of ornate living rooms that they're all perched in with their sort of facelifts and so forth. They're all the men are tanned and have got cigars and all that kind of stuff.
It's like one of her novels.
It is. They've like all stepped out of one of her novels. And that was very enjoyable, I have to say.
Yeah, my only downside of it was that I wanted more. I wanted to know even more and would very happily watch the Joan Collins version.
Lady Boss 2.
So, Matt, you going to watch it?
Sounds very interesting. Yeah, I know literally nothing about Jackie Collins, really, so there'll be a lot to learn from me from this.
I don't think you need to, though. I think it's more about that somebody lived in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s in the eye of the storm of Hollywood and was surrounded by all those people, was at Tramp nightclub in London and, you know, was hanging out with everybody that you should hang out with in that era, and then was basically taking notes of all of it and putting it and pouring it into dirty novels, which women loved.
It was nice to see some clips of Dynasty as well.
Yes. Oh God, I loved Dynasty.
Joan in her prime.
Oh, do you remember like Blake Carrington, and he was married to Crystal, and Crystal went bananas and started throwing dinner plates down the stairs. One of my greatest ever moments. Honestly, does anywhere show Dynasty? Because I would watch that show all over again.
I'm sure you can find it somewhere. Get the box
I love set. I love the Collins sisters. So I think I'm probably biased on this film. But if you fancy watching Lady Boss, the Jackie Collins story, it's available in cinemas this Friday. Wear leopard print. I think it's only right. So before we go, it's time for a reader's question. What's the best movie song or movie soundtrack? Matt?
We're going soundtrack. I'd have to say, as I answered this recently for the magazine, I would have to stick with Saturday Night Fever, just because I think not only is it just like banger after banger after banger, that you just, 100% associate with the film, but also the fact that it is just so melded with the film. You know, it works as an album in its own right, but it's just kind of inseparable with the sort of, you know, feel of the film, you know, and the success of the film. So that I'd go for soundtrack. And then for song, personally, I just have to go for Ghostbusters, just because I just love it when they have those big songs that sort of, you know, always have a life outside of the film. And I miss those days when you had just like a massive song that was just, you just knew was the song of the film. And especially like, you know, when it specifically references like the title and themes of the film.
And when you saw it on Top of the Pops, like it had like film clips in it, or the actors from the film had actually come in to do a special video. That's when you knew you had a really great tune and a great movie.
When was the last time we had one of those, you know? Like, whereas a proper like song that's properly like thematically tied to the film, you know, and was a proper big deal, you know, because you obviously get like, you know,
Bond pop, certain, you know,
pop songs. Well, I'd say Skyfall. Adele's Skyfall was the last great big kind of theme that I can think of. I mean, I would have to go for song. If we're on the Bond, you know, the Bond vibe, I'd go for Carly Simon's Nobody Does It Better, which is...
absolute classic.
Absolute stonker. And then soundtrack, this is quite a random one, but I'm completely obsessed, or at least have been in the past, by the Tron Legacy soundtrack by Daft Punk. I mean, the film was what it was, but that soundtrack is absolutely incredible. And I've just listened to that over and over and over again. So there you go. Also, the Goodfellas soundtrack is one of the greatest, you know, of the kind of 60s and 70s. Yeah, jukebox movies, incredible piece of work there.
If I was going for soundtrack, I'm very partial to The Mission. When that sort of oboe, is it an oboe or is it a flute? I don't even know. I don't know my instruments. But
wind instruments.
It's a wind instrument when it's like, doo-doo-doo-doo. It's just, or it gets me every time. It gives me the shivers. And song, Dirty Dancing's I've Had the Time of My Life, is so classic and a so of a period. But equally, I'd have to say Everything I Do It For You. We love a bit of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves in the Office, and that was number one forever, wasn't it? Like, I had birthdays and that was still number one. It was such a huge thing, and it just feels like it's so much part of my life and my history that I'd have to choose that one too.
And again, that comes back to like when we were younger and you just didn't have YouTube and things like that. Just seeing the video and you got to see little clips of the film. That was like, oh my God, you know, that I actually get to see like a few snippets. I mean, to be honest, it gives away a lot of the film actually in that video, if I recall correctly. It's pretty much just like a short summation of the film. But I mean, as a kid, I just lapped it up, you know.
Yeah.
Quality whizzing arrows.
And arrows being split down the middle. And a lot of Brian Adams just like roaming around a sort of smoke-filled forest mood.
There's been a lot on Twitter recently about that film, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and people saying it's not very good. What's going on? I mean, I haven't watched it for a very long time, but I remember it being hugely enjoyable, despite the Brian Adams song, which had slightly plagued us, I think, after 16 weeks at number one. But yeah, I don't quite understand where this negativity about Kevin as Robin as came from.
I think it's not a good film. I mean, I don't think anyone would say, oh, you know, this is, you know, beautifully written and wonderfully acted and, you know, everything is completely historically accurate and but that's not the point of it, is it? It's completely not the point. The point is that Alan Rickman thought, yeah, I'm going for this in a Blackadder Part 2 style way. Kevin Costner thought, I'm not even going to bother. I'm just turning up in a mullet. And the charisma of those two coming off the screen made up for all of those shortfalls. And then it's just like a romp, isn't it? Totally anachronistic. Just his journey from, what does he do? He pitches up at Seven Sisters, manages to come via Hadrian's Wall on his way to Nottingham, via Yorkshire. I mean, just none of it makes sense, but it's a great film.
I must revisit it. It was one of my most watched films in childhood. And I was quite scared of the old hag as well.
Yes. The Painted Man. And she's like, take her. She is ripe. She's awful, isn't she? I love her. But yeah, and Alan Rickman, absolutely corking in that. You know, you love Hans Gruber, but this is another amazing baddie that he put together. I love him. It's great. And that's all I'll have to say on this, because there is no other version. Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves is a corker. We're taking a break from the podcast next week, so do join us in 2 weeks' time. But for now, we'll say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
You, my room, 10:30 tonight. You, 10:45. Bring a friend. Look into my eyes.